Welcome to your commercial-free, uninterrupted investment show, sponsored by the SEC-registered investment firm, Wilsey Asset Management, a fiduciary firm owned and operated by President Brent Wilsey, who has been putting clients' investment needs first for over 40 years. The Smart Investing Show has been giving unbiased financial information for over 27 years on local radio stations right here in San Diego, providing you with fundamental analysis on stocks and investments you want to know about. Now, here are your hosts, Brent and Chase Wilsey.
Well, hello and welcome to the Smart Investing Show. I'm Brent Wilsey, president of Wilsey Asset Management. Great to have you here with the Smart Investing Show. Now, normally this time I introduce you to Chase, but Chase on Thursday had his first baby. So he is taking care of that baby. He'll be back next week. But congratulations to Chase on his first baby girl. Georgiana Drew Wilsey is her name. So Chase will be back next week. And with me this week, you've heard him many times on the show. Every week you hear him on the show is Harrison. Harrison, thanks for being with us today.
Always good to be here. Good to call in usually, but now I get to be in the studio. So
yes, in person. So we'll be talking a little bit more today than usual. We do have some things to cover that Harrison's going to help me on. I'm going to be talking about 401k loans, what's going on with them. Actually, also to our president of our countrywide county lending, Robert Behick, is going to talk more about that too, comparing them to HELOCs, but we're going to hit more on 401k loans as well. Also, hype investing. We always talk about that at Wilsey Asset Management. We are value investing investors. We're going to talk about hype investing. And then U.S. farmland, another thing that we find very interesting. We're not investing into it yet, but we thought we'd give you some numbers on that. And then Harrison has some topics he'll be covering on financial planning with us. And then companies, I'm going to try to cover these companies today if we can get to them. Domino's Pizza, gosh, their stock just keep going up. And it's kind of amazing to me how many people eat pizza, continue to eat pizza. Amazing on the stock. We'll look at that to see if it's time to buy it or not. And then also, we got to cover Weight Watchers because, well, Oprah Winfrey is leaving the board. There's an interesting story behind that. We'll talk about that. And is it time to now buy Weight Watchers? And then we're going to try to cover also Starbucks. Has it lost its steam? And then if we have time, Whirlpool. And Harrison, you've got, why don't you tell what your topics are? We'll tease with those, and we'll go right into the 401k loans.
So yeah, I'll talk a little bit about long-term care insurance. We had a client actually email in and provide some comments on that, and I think it's a good topic to talk about. And then in the spirit of Chase's new fatherhood, we're going to talk a little bit about life insurance and when that makes sense and when it doesn't.
Yeah, and that's a really big time when you have children, start having children. That's really when, well, we won't take away from your segment. All right. Well, let's go to the 401k loans. It was nice to see that retirement assets saw a nice increase in 2023. Now, according to Fidelity, the average 401k was up 14% from a year earlier to $118,600. And the average IRA, well, that was up 12% to $116,000. What is good to see this progress, balances are still short of the year end 2021, when levels with the average 401k reached $136,000 and the average IRA stood at $131,000. I was somewhat surprised by, but still happy to see the average 401k contribution rate, including employer and employee, now stands at 13.9%. I usually recommend about 15%, so we're getting close to that. With a decline in companies offering pensions, employees really need to make sure they are saving at least 10% of their pay to achieve an enjoyable retirement.
On the other side of the equation, we were disappointed to see the percentage of workers who took a loan from their 401k, including for hardship reasons, that increased to 8.9% from 7.8% at the end of 2022. Many times people believe 401k loans are a great option, but it costs you greatly when you consider the loss of compounding and the tax inefficiency. They are better than mounting interest on credit card debt, but they should only be used as a last resort tool rather than to fund vacation or a new toy or something like that.
You know, we put that in there, and I hate to see that, but I've seen it happen with people do say, well, you know, I've got a lot of money in there. I'm going to go on vacation. Like, no, this is for your retirement. You don't know what's going to happen. You don't know how long you're going to live in retirement. Why would you risk taking out too much money from your retirement and have a terrible retirement?
Well, I think the whole name of it is a little misleading because you're not taking a loan from your 401k. You're taking a withdrawal from it. You're withdrawing from yourself. And, you know, people look at it as a benefit because you're paying yourself back. You know, the interest that you're paying is paying yourself back, but The downside of that is that means your money's not working for you, so it's not growing and compounding. And the 401k is a long-term vehicle, and really what makes it special is its ability to stay in that tax-deferred account for so long, which increases that compounding. So if you're constantly borrowing or withdrawing that money, it's not compounding, it's not working for you. But the other big thing I think a lot of people miss is the interest that you pay into it. You're essentially making a non-deductible contribution to your 401k, and then when you withdraw that interest later on in retirement, you're taxed on it again. So you're basically double taxed on the interest that you're quote unquote paying yourself back.
And you know, the rumor is like, oh, it's just the best thing ever. You get to borrow and pay yourself back. You know, I've pounded the table on this. I've talked about doing the 401k. You give up the numbers of why people shouldn't do it. If you hear somebody doing that, have them call Harrison, have them call me. Like, no, it is the worst thing to do ever. I can't think of a really good reason to take from your 401k or borrow from your 401k. It has to be really something dramatic.
The only thing I would say is, you know, if you have credit card debt at 30%, you know, that's pretty much it.
Right.
Because, you know, if you withdraw that and have to pay it back, it's still not as costing you as much as your 30% credit card debt is. But other than that, I would look at any other type of financing. I know Robert's going to come and talk a little bit about HELOCs. I think that's a better option, even in a higher interest rate environment, and other types of personal loans. And I mean, really with the 401k, you're limited on time as well, because you have to get that money back in within a 5-year time horizon, or else you'll have additional taxes on it. So, you know, like you said, Brent, I think it's really the last resort other than real high credit card interest.
And I'll tell you, I'm a little bit older than you are, and I'll tell you why I don't even agree with a 30% thing, because I've seen this happen. Oh, yeah, that's a good idea. I'm going to take that money out. I'm going to pay off those high interest loans at credit cards at 30%, whatever it is. That's going to be great. 5 years later.
Yep.
They've taken the money from the 401k and they got the exact same debt with the exact same interest rate again. So my feeling is, keep that debt, take the pain of paying such a high amount, and you'll hopefully learn not to do that again. But if you make it too easy to pay it off, they're back in 5 years with the same debt and less money than 401k.
Yeah, you know, so you're exactly right on that. When you bring in the behavior of people and how they actually operate, sometimes the 401k loan seems like too simple of an option, and then you're right. Now you've got build up the credit card debt again, and you still have a 401k loan. So now you're worse on both sides.
Exactly. Well, let's talk about hype investing, because we're so against that at Wealth Asset Management. We talk about the fundamental investing, good investing, so that when you need it, it's there for you. At Wealth Asset Management, we do avoid hype investing. From time to time, we attempt to give evidence of how long-term hype investing can destroy your portfolio. Here's another example. In 2021, you may recall the hype around electric vehicles. People made it sound as if internal combustion engine vehicles would never be sold again, and we'd all be driving electric vehicles. Well, the hype of the stock matched the excitement. Two examples are Lucid and Rivian. The all-time high a couple years ago for Lucid was $35. Recently, it has fallen to under $3 a share. That is a 91% decline.
The other example is Rivian. In late 2021, it hit an all-time high of $146 per share, and it has recently fallen under $11 a share. That's a 92.5% decline. It is possible for these companies to turn around and may do well in the years to come, but the massive decline in stock price is the reason we will not invest in a company which does not have earnings, and we will not pay more than 10 to maybe 12 times for those earnings going forward. We may miss out on some of the high flyers, but we'd rather take it slow and steady than try to hit a home run and potentially lose 80 to 90% on an investment. And for example, Lucid, for them to get back to that $35 a share, they would need over 1,000% return from where they're currently at.
You know, and I hope people listen to that, because wouldn't it be nice to have 1,000% return? Very rare. Maybe over your lifetime, maybe you can get that type of return.
Yeah.
But it's just, that is just phenomenal. And that's why we talk about these things. And it's not just EVs. I use that because that's the most recent example. And I'm sure you remember a few years ago, 2-3 years ago, electric vehicles, that's going to be the whole thing. Shouldn't buy any more, you know, gas cars. Shouldn't buy GM. Shouldn't do this. It's like, no, this is another hype situation. It's not going to happen. I've said that by the year 2035, 2040, I think what you'll have is you'll have different options. You'll have the option of a gas car. You'll have the option of electric vehicle, maybe biodiesel, you know, hydrogen. You'll have different options, but EVs are not going to take it away. And people got burned on those stocks. And I think maybe Rivian can last. I'm not sure about Lucid. Rivian might last, but it's not going to go back to $140 a share. I mean, it might go back up to the mid-20s, and it could take time for that to happen.
Well, it's good to bring up those case studies, too, because there's always some hype going on, you know, whether it's Bitcoin, whether it's NVIDIA, whether it's electric vehicles, whether it's weed stocks. I mean, there's always something exciting, but nobody ever buys at the absolute bottom. And no one ever sells at the absolute top. So you can look back and say, oh, well, you know, if I would have bought this at this date and then sold that at that date, I would have made 200%. Yeah, but nobody does that. Absolutely right. Nobody. And when we look at investing, the whole point of investing is to grow money consistently so that you can create future income. That's the purpose. And nobody has been able to guess the right hype stocks before the hype comes up and been able to consistently share in that appreciation. And if you have, you know, you're a billionaire by now, because if you consistently make a few 100% per year, it doesn't take long to grow a lot. So, you know, when you look at investing and you look forward, well, the next 20, 30, 40 years, basically the rest of your life, the best thing you can do is have consistent returns, avoid losing lots of money, do that consistently, and then, you know, that's how you'll make the most money in the long term.
And I think some people just like the bragging rights, where it's like, okay, well, you know, I'm going to buy 10 shares of Lucid at $3 a share, and now it's up to 35. See how great I did. I think they like that. But when it comes to actually managing their serious money, they've got to be very careful, because now you're taking larger percentages. And if you have a, we'll say, $100,000 portfolio, and you bought 10 shares of Lucid at, we'll say, at 35, that's only $350. I mean, it's not going to move the needle on your portfolio. You can do it for fun. I put it in the category of gambling. Mm-hmm. Go to Vegas, go to the track, do whatever you want to do. But to really do your serious money and these hype investments, and I've seen people in my 40-plus years doing this where they get to retirement, you know, 55, 60. Well, I didn't do very good. I've only got, you know, 100,000. It's like, yeah, you may wait until you're 75. You have a choice.
And in that case, usually you don't really get to experience the compounding, because you might win, but then you might lose. And then you win, you catch back up, and then you lose. So you're always kind of fluttering around the same amount, as opposed to, you know, if you can make 10% a year for 30 years, that's a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And so really that's the goal that you should have, not, well, how can I double my money this year? Because next year, even if you could do it this year, you're not going to do it next year. You're not going to do it the year after that.
And to the emotional side of it, it's going to scare you. And I've seen this happen where you lost all this money. Oh, I'm getting out. Stocks are too risky. I'm never going to invest in stocks again. You did a silly thing, and now you've destroyed your attitude that about investing in great businesses. And I think it was Warren Buffett called compounding interest the
eighth wonder of the world.
There we go. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So slow and steady, you know, that's the way. And again, I don't think there's anything wrong with making an 8, 10, maybe 12% return on average per year. And that does not mean every year you'll get that. 1 year you could lose some money, next year you make maybe 15, 20%, but over 10 years, if you average 8, 10, 12%, you'll do pretty well.
Yeah, when we say slow and steady, we're not talking about 3% per year. We want to make money too, we just want to do it consistently.
Yeah, if you make 10%, your money doubles about once every 7 years.
Yep.
So let's talk about farmland, U.S. farmland, because farmland in the United States has been on quite the ride for the past 26 years. Back in 1997, the average price per acre for farmland in the U.S. was $1,270. It has now increased by over 430% to $5,500 per acre. Now, before you people in San Diego think this is just not a good because appreciation use on your house, remember, this is a nationwide, and a 4% plus return is very good on real estate. Don't be spoiled by being in San Diego here.
Yeah, 430% is phenomenal for real estate. The question is, will it continue? Or for the last 20 years, farm acreage has declined by about 50 million acres to just under 900 million acres nationwide. Development has been taking away some of the agricultural land, which could drive prices higher. That could encourage farmers to take advantage of their high-value real estate and retire Which would be a good thing for them, but not a great thing for our agricultural needs going forward.
And one thing I didn't write in this post here was I did not write the number of farmers, because I'm pretty sure that there's less people farming today than back in the 90s as well. That is a problem. I mean, I don't know anybody. I don't know if you know anybody. Like, yeah, when I grow up, I want to be a farmer.
it's not that common. I think my grandmother actually has some farmland
really?
In Illinois. I've never seen it or been there. I don't really know much about it, but I think it exists. But I think you're right, Brent. I think the number of farmers has gone down consistently. Now you can say that technology has increased to the point where, you know, our output per acreage is maybe better than what it was, but we're always going to eat. We're always going to need food.
You're always going to need food, and that's why it is a great investment. And we looked at companies like John Deere, they've now got tractors that are pretty much automated. They can do things faster, but you still need the land, the farmland, to produce it. There's no magic to that. I guess there may be some things now that supposedly you can make in the laboratory, maybe, but mm-hmm. I like my food coming from the ground.
Yeah. More natural that way.
So if you want more information on that, because these come from our newsletter. We do a newsletter. It goes out every Friday at 5:00. It's free. It doesn't cost you anything. It has other topics in there like the Bitcoin ETF. We talk about that. Underemployed college graduates, that's in there. Walmart acquiring Vizio, that's in there. Wall Street gain from Bitcoin, higher hotel rates, all these things are in that newsletter. It is free. Go to our website, smartinvesting2000.com. That's smartinvesting2000.com. It's right in the middle of the page. Sign up for it. You'll get it by email every Friday, just about, I think it goes out right at 5:00. So smartinvesting2000.com. Well, Harrison, you mentioned on the financial planning side, we want to talk about, is long-term care insurance worth it? I see this a lot. I've often wondered the question, you know, I don't have the answer. You do, you're the financial planner, because it can be very expensive. Is it really worth it?
It can, and that's what kind of brought this up. We had a client after the show last week send us an email talking about he's got some neighbors with some insurance, and so I wanted to talk about it a little bit. So this client said that he's got some neighbors that are paying over $13,000 a year for their insurance premiums. Now, the cost of elder care later in life can be expensive, whether it's a nursing home, you have a caregiver, assisted living, all that can be expensive. And anyone who is going through that or had a parent go through that knows this. One thing I hear a lot is, oh, well, my mom or dad needed long-term care, but fortunately they had this long-term care insurance policy, which really helped out a lot. So they've had that positive experience with the insurance policies. The problem is, those insurance policies do not exist anymore, at least in that capacity. So here's what's happened in the long-term care industry. It started in the 80s, and at that time, almost every financial company would sell the policies, not just insurance companies. So there's a lot of providers out there. And ultimately, when you look at insurance, any type of insurance, auto, home, long-term care, life, whatever it is, the purpose of insurance is to cover an event that is not likely to happen, so low probability. But if it does happen, it would be financially catastrophic. So high impact, low probability, high impact. Like your house is probably not likely to burn down, but if it did, it'd be terrible, and that's why you have insurance for it. So you pay a little premium for that protection. In the case of long-term care, it was thought to be a low probability, high impact event, but over time, the insurance companies have discovered that it was definitely expensive, so high impact, but it also was occurring more often than they thought. So it actually is more of a high probability event. So this means it's difficult to cover that need with insurance. And what happens is more and more insurance companies no longer sell it. They've been getting out of that industry. And the ones that do continue to sell it have drastically increased the premiums and have drastically cut the benefits in an attempt to stay profitable. So these policies that your parents bought with lifetime benefits and low premiums, you just can't buy them anymore. Now, if you already have a policy like that, it could make sense to keep it, but I would be hard-pressed to recommend someone buying one in this environment just because the cost-to-benefit ratio now is not what it used to be. Now, that doesn't mean the need isn't there. It just needs to be covered by something else. For many, that protection can come from their home or the equity there they have in their home. During retirement, you create income from Social Security, pensions, and investable assets. And in most cases, the only thing you use your home for is to live in. Well, if necessary, that home equity can be tapped to cover elder care costs later in life without needing to purchase expensive policies along the way. And also, when you look at someone requiring elder care, while it is expensive, they're not really doing much else. They're not taking expensive trips or going out and spending a lot of money in other ways. So really, the money that they were spending in their early retirement years is now shifting to elder care. So elder care isn't really a huge expense that gets added on top to everything else. It's more of a transition from really where you're allocating your cash flow.
And I remember insurance companies, some of them really got beat up bad by this. They actually, a couple went bankrupt because they couldn't afford, and this is a shame to say, people were living longer than they expected, and they had to pay it a lot more, and that caused some major financial problems. And so what you're saying is they've cut the benefits and raised the premiums because good people are living longer, but that's a higher insurance need they have to cover a much longer period. And you really got to weigh this out in financial planning. Let me ask you this question. We didn't talk about this before the show, but I mean, do you have any idea percentage-wise how many people come through your office for financial planning that don't have a good long-term care plan set up that they could be in trouble?
Well, a lot of people that I see don't have the insurance, and it's a question that they have. I mean, elder care, and you know, a lot of people know that it's expensive, but you know, people are wondering about how to go about doing it. And so when we put a plan together, we have to account for that potential cost later on in retirement. But again, retirement is really just about managing cash flow. We have to have the right income sources all the way through retirement. And as you go through retirement, you'll have periods where some cash flow is going to travel, like in your 60s. And then as you get into your 80s and 90s, you're kind of slowing down a little bit. So now we have some extra cash flow that we weren't traveling anymore. Now we can, you know, apply it to elder care. So it needs to be accounted for. I mean, the cost of elder care can be $10,000 a month, sometimes more in some cases. But, you know, you just have to, you have to have a need for it. And again, one option can be using the equity that you have in your home. Even people who go into retirement with a mortgage, well, you're going to continue to make those payments as you go through, and your equity in that home should continue to grow as you pay that mortgage down. So if you needed to access some of that equity later on, you know, there's a, you know, a big pool there that you can access if you need to.
And we do have Robert Behick, again, president of Countywide Mortgage Lending, coming on. But one option too for people that you might look into is reverse mortgage. That may make sense, could be expensive, but again, is that something to look at as well?
Absolutely. And I mean, there's a negative connotation about that. Absolutely. However, in some cases it can make sense. And we've had, we don't sell these things, we don't sell anything. So it all comes down to the numbers for us. But we've had clients that have gotten reverse mortgages and they're like, we love it. It's great.
Yeah.
I mean, we had this home that has $1 million of equity and all we're doing is living in there. Well, we can get a reverse mortgage. Now we're withdrawing $3,000 a month. That's not taxable because it's technically a loan. And, you know, as long as you understand really what you're doing, you're borrowing against the equity in your house. But, you know, if your goal is not to die with a $2 million home that's paid off, then a reverse mortgage could be something that could be used to pay for elder care or, you know, any other cash flow need in retirement.
And it depends a lot on the people too. I mean, we have clients, what I'm thinking of, he's like 85, full of energy, wouldn't even know he's 85. We have clients that are 60, and my gosh, they're just like not doing very well. I mean, how do you take that into account for these people? I mean, and I think it's something that they have to do that themselves to say, gee, I had longevity in my family, I should do well. Or I mean, myself, my mom died at 48, my dad died at 53. I mean, I'm way above what mm-hmm. he should be, and I feel fine. But I'm just saying, there's so many factors to weigh here, because it's expensive. You have different options. I think the best one is if you've done a good thing, as we talked about, building your 401k, building your house, you should be able to be self-insured.
In many cases, you are. And back to the long-term care insurance, because the actuarial tables that insurance companies are using now are, you know, basically factoring in that everyone is going to need it. When you buy that insurance, you're basically prepaying it, whether or not you actually use it. And so it's almost a form of self-insurance because the premiums that you're paying in are so large. And then when you actually get to the point where you may or may not need it, you might only get benefits for 2 years or 3 years or maybe 5 years on the longer side. And that covers a portion of it. But if you needed, you know, care for longer than that, you know, the insurance company isn't going to help you. So you're going to have additional assets or additional income sources in order to cover that.
Another thing people need to talk about their financial planner with, and again, we don't sell at Wilson Asset Management. Harrison, you don't sell any products at all. You're on a salary. We do fee-based planning. If you want to have a free consultation with Harrison, because this is something concerned for you, give him a call at the office, 858 858- 858-224-0004. Again, that's 858-224-0004. Go to the website, smartinvesting2000.com. That's smartinvesting2000.com. You do get a free consultation with Harrison. Sometimes those last, I've seen it like, he's been there for a long time.
The consultations themselves usually don't last too long. They're about an hour or so. But then when I'm actually presenting a plan, I mean, I've had them go 4 hours, sometimes longer than that, because it, you know, we look at everything. We explain how it all works. We explain the recommendations, because you know, I can tell you pretty simply or pretty quickly what you should do, but the why is what everyone's really curious about and wants to know. So explaining that why, how taxes work, how cash flow works, how, you know, we're going to create income, how we're going to reduce future taxation, it takes a while to go through that. But after it, you know exactly what you're going to do and why you're doing it.
All right. Well, let's move on to companies. We got a couple minutes here before the break. Domino's Pizza. I actually love their pizza.
I do too. I like it too.
I think a lot of people do as well, because the stock has done so well. Company again, Domino's Pizza. Their symbol DPZ. They're in the industry of restaurants. 4.8% short on the float side. That's not too bad. 96% institutional owned. PE ratio, unfortunately, kind of high, 30.6, above the industry at 28.4. Price of sales also high, 3.5 versus 2.7. Unfortunately, no price to book value, which means if you take away all the liabilities and the assets, there's no value there, no equity. That is not good. The industry does have a price to book value of 22.8. Price to cash flow, 26.8 versus 17.8. They do have a good PEG ratio. And again, the lower that number, the better, 2.4 versus 5.7. Now, a lot of people are eating pizzas, up 17% on their earnings over the year. The industry, though, this is the restaurant industry, up 60%. We know the industry of restaurants have done very well. Unfortunately, sales for Domino's are down 1.3% versus 5.9% for the industry. 5-year growth rate on Domino's Pizza going forward by the analysts, 12.3%, only 11.9% for the industry. So a lot of people keeping that pizza. We do see the dividend yield is 1.4 versus 1.9. We do have a current ratio here on the balance sheet, 1.5 versus 1.1, so that shows some good liquidity. Debt equity, nothing there, because remember, they have no equity. They've got more liabilities than they have assets. That does kind of concern me. Net profit margin, 11.6 versus 9.5. That's pretty good. Return on equity, well, a negative 12.7 versus a negative 230. Now, one thing Chase and I talk about is that this, I think they have a lot of franchises, so there could be something going on with that. Very rare to say negative return on equity, but you got to look at the financial statements to understand why that is. Looking at the price, the current price is $447. That is, well, I'm going to come back to what the high was and low, because I hear we got the break coming up. So you're listening to Smart Investing Show with Brent and Chase. Today with me is Harrison. We're talking about Domino's Pizza. We'll be right back after this break. Alrighty, welcome back to Smart Investing Show. We left off talking about Domino's Pizza. Yes, that is life, having pizza. I gotta say, during the break here, I was talking to Frank, our producer here, and I was talking about Domino's Pizza, and I hate to say it, but he goes, "That's not pizza. He's from New York. You gotta have New York pizza." And I said, "What about Chicago?" "No, gotta have New York pizza." I wish I had a microphone there, Frank, because I'm sorry, I still like Domino's Pizza. All right, so let's get back to the numbers here, because we left off about, as far as what their price was, it's $447.23. The high, very close to that, $476.18. The low, here's the excitement, $285 a share. The big question is it now time to buy it? Should you be selling this company? For that, we turn to the analyst estimates. There's 32 analysts that follow this company. For the year ending December 2024, they're giving earnings estimates of $15.72. That's about the same it's been for the past 90 days. Unfortunately, you use our conservative multiple of 16.6 times earnings, which is the average about over the last 40 years on the Ford PE. Well, 16.5 times 15.72 gives you a price of $260.95. So we can eat the pizza, but we cannot eat the stock. We got to say no to this stock.
Pizza's pretty reasonably priced, I think, if you buy two medium-sized pizza. They're each like $7 or something. So
yeah, see, it's the price. What does a New York pizza cost, Frank? Like, what does it cost?
Buy it by the slice there.
Yeah, buy by the slice. That's right. And then even I brought, well, Chicago pizza. Nope. Got to have New York. And I think I'm in the studio by myself because you guys both like New York pizza. And then I talk about my Nutrisystem pizza, but we're getting too far into the pizza side. So let's just talk about enjoy the pizza, but don't buy the stock. So, Harrison, you had something else that I think we want to talk about, too. I know we got Robert Behick coming up here pretty soon, but you had another topic. Since you're here, I want to take advantage of your time on financial planning. What was the other topic you talked about? The life insurance. Right?
Life insurance, yes. Yeah.
So let's go sell life insurance. Right? Yeah.
Still in the insurance vein, long-term care insurance, life insurance. But the reason I wanted to talk about this, it kind of goes in tangent with Chase being a dad as of Thursday, right on leap year. So that'll be fun for them. But, you know, with Chase, and Chase and I have talked about this, and you know, anytime you have a new family, this is a case where life insurance is necessary. The time you really need life insurance is when you have people who are dependent on you to work to create income. So in other words, when you have a family who is financially dependent on the wages that you earn. Life insurance death benefits are tax-free and they avoid probate. We could talk about life insurance as an investment income source or as an estate planning tool, which is a totally different conversation. But primarily, life insurance is there to take care of your loved ones. And in cases where someone has a young family, I always recommend term insurance. For someone who is 30 years old in relatively good health, they can get a 20-year million-dollar policy for about $40 a month. Some people don't like the idea of term because if they don't get any benefit of it, they don't get any benefit unless they die. So they could be paying premiums for 20 years and get nothing out of it, to which I say, that's good. Number one, you don't want to die. And two, you don't want to submit claims for any insurance that you have. You don't want to get into a car accident. You don't want your house to flood or anything like that. So best case scenario for any type of insurance is you pay your premiums and you never have to use it. And if you're still not convinced, there are permanent policies out there that will last for the rest of your life. But the difference is the premiums are much, much higher. For that 30-year-old wanting a million-dollar policy, the lowest premium option for a permanent policy would be a universal life insurance policy that is not designed to build cash value. So basically the minimum premium required to stay in force for your lifetime. Well, that would cost about $700 per month compared to the $40 a month term. So it's a huge difference.
Wait, $700 versus $40?
Yeah.
And you said the universal is not building up anything?
Not building up cash flow. It will a little bit, but that's not the purpose of it. You could pay more than $700 to build up cash value, but the minimum payment just to keep it for your lifetime would be around close to $700 a month.
And the $40, is that a annual renewable term or is that a term?
20-year fixed term.
Wow.
So $40 a month, $480 a year for 20 years, and you get same million-dollar coverage.
You may have done this, but over 20 years, what is somebody saving?
So that's what we'll get to, yeah.
I didn't see your notes.
So again, $700 a month, that's a lot. If it was whole life or a cash value policy, then it would be even more. So anyways, if you wanted insurance that lasts for your lifetime and guarantees that your family gets that $1 million, if you buy a policy at 30 and live until, let's say, 80, that means you're paying $700 a month for 50 years. If you calculate your return on that $700 a month to get the million 50 years from now, it's about a 3% per year return, which is terrible.
Right.
And that's why insurance companies sell these, because they make money off of it. I'd say you're better off sticking with term, investing the rest of your money somewhere else. And the other part of it is you don't need life insurance forever. You only need it until you have enough assets that can replace your income, whether that's a 401k, rental properties, investment accounts, whatever. Those assets will continue to produce income if you die. So life insurance is really just there to replace your wages. And usually a 20-year term policy is good enough.
And exactly. And that's supposed to create the immediate state. But if you're doing all the things that you're supposed to be doing correctly, and I'm mainly talking about here, we talked about the 401k, not taking loans from it, but taking the 401k and taking that $700 a month and put into your 401k. Well, no, it won't be 700 because you said the term was what, 40, right?
$40 a month, yeah.
So you take $660, you put that into your 401k, get the tax deduction, invest it properly. Don't put it in the money market, invest it properly. 20 years, you're going to be so far ahead, you probably don't need any more insurance because you've created your own estate.
Yeah, and that's exactly it. I mean, insurance is there if you don't have the assets and people depend on your income. Once you get to the point where you're nearing retirement, or your dependents are now grown up, you've got more equity in your house, so you're not worried so much about your mortgage, that's the point where you don't really need a death benefit anymore, because if something did happen to you, well, you've got enough assets that you've accumulated over that time where, you know, your family will be okay.
Right. And again, I have to say this, our job is to educate people. The commissions on insurance are very high. I'm going to say they're probably around 70-75% for the first year.
Sometimes they can be more than that. So yeah, if someone sells a $700 a month policy, that's close to $8,000 a year in premium, which means they might make, you know, $6,000 or $7,000 on that. That's a whole lot more than if they sell a $40 a month policy and get, you know, $200 or whatever it is.
And it's hard because of the fact that you can't make a living off of doing that, but you should not make a living off of selling life insurance if you got to charge people a higher amount. That's why, and again, when people come to you and we don't sell insurance, where do you send them if they should get a 20-year term policy? What are you telling them to do?
There's a couple of places. So we have access to a kind of a wholesale life insurance group or a wholesale annuity group. They sell a whole bunch of things, which again, we don't use that often. But in cases like this where someone needs life insurance, we look at that. I used to sell life insurance back in the day. I don't anymore. I don't sell anything. But
we took you away from that.
Yeah, they took me on to bigger and better things. So like in Chase's case, he just bought some insurance. And so there was a company that I used to, you know, kind of have access to so I can run quotes and things like that. And they've always been pretty competitive in their pricing. And so, you know, we kind of just compare a couple things. But with life insurance, you really do it once and that's pretty much it. And in Chase's case, he got his policy. He didn't even have to do any health underwriting. They he's paying his premium and he has his insurance. He has a term policy and he's good to go. So it's all very simple.
And I think if I remember the story from years ago, you weren't doing that well in life insurance because you had a hard time selling things that you didn't feel.
Well, I was selling the term stuff. that was the problem because I'm like, I was looking at the numbers and I was like, I would not want to buy this $700 policy for myself or, you know, this whole life policy or these cash value policies. You're paying all this money into it. And yeah, you can say, well, you can borrow against the cash value and do all these things, but it wasn't as good as just investing your money. And so, you know, I was talking to potential prospects and this term policy at $15 a month will do you just fine, and yeah, I make $3 from it, so
I'm sure your manager is saying, Harrison, son, what are you doing?
Yeah,
you gotta sell these higher ones, but it makes no sense.
I did that for about a year and, you know, found something better. Started working with you guys, so it worked out better.
And we're glad we brought you over because you're a great financial planner. But I could not recommend life insurance unless, like Chase's situation. Did he do the 20-year term?
Yeah.
So, and I think he'll be fine. He may not need it that long, but, and that's the thing too. If you don't need it, you can just.
That's exactly right. There's no penalty or anything to cancel it. You can, I like to keep, you know, a 20-year. If you only need it for 17 years, all right, we'll go ahead and cancel it and you can stop paying the premiums.
All part of financial planning. When someone comes in and talks to you about different things, that's what you talk about, kind of direct them to where to get the term insurance. Not like, oh, let's buy universal life and we'll make a, what do you say, $6,000 a year off it or something?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, so, all right, let's see. Let's switch on over to, I think we'll talk about Weight Watchers. Is Robert here with us? Is Robert saying? You know, let's talk about because his topic is today, why you should use a HELOC, I love this, versus borrowing from your 401k. So let's turn to Robert Beherick. Robert, you with us?
I am.
All right, how you doing there?
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm doing great. How about yourself?
Good. I don't know if you heard the first part of the show, but we kind of talked a little bit about 401ks. I mentioned you'd be coming on later in the show to talk more about it because, you know, people think, well, that's the only option I have. And you're talking about why you should use a HELOC versus borrowing from your 401k. Give us some reasons.
Well, I was just meeting with some clients, and they were considering the same thing. And when you start to look at what the tax consequences, the penalties that they may or may not incur along with the taxes that would go along with that withdrawal, comparatively to getting a home equity line of credit or even refinancing and getting the cash out, that might be tax deductible depending on what it's used for, it's a huge difference. Right? I mean, it's the swing, it could be night and day.
And Robert, somebody goes to you and they're looking at those options. I mean, do you kind of weigh the differences for them? You explain the tax situation. Do you kind of listen to what they're using the money for? I mean, how do you handle people when they come to you like that?
It all starts with a conversation. So we go through and we run the numbers, and then seek the advice of tax people to give us some information, and then, yeah, they can sleep on their options and see what's what. But I will tell you, 9 times out of 10, that the home equity line of credit, especially for a client that I just was helping, she was able to save thousands, tens of thousands of dollars in taxes by doing this way versus pulling out her 401k money.
Yeah, because sometimes they don't even borrow from it. They just want to pull it out. They don't realize what it's going to be. And this is why, you know, I tell people, and we had a client that waited till the very end. I had a client today we talked to. He's looking at moving to Massachusetts in a few months. So he's starting to put together a plan. Okay, I want to buy a house in Massachusetts, going to Cape Cod. You know, how can I do that? What can we? It makes it so much easier to do the planning and talk to the financial planner, talk to your investment advisor, talk to your mortgage person, talk to your CPA, talk, you know, get a plan that could save you thousands, maybe tens of thousands of dollars.
It's so true. Education is king. And by waiting to last minute and then making those knee-jerk reactions emotionally, it can really cost you a lot of money, unfortunately.
And Robert, I'm sure there's different types of HELOCs. I mean, what ones work best? Are there different ones for different times? Somebody needs one now. What should they be looking at?
So it depends on how long they're going to need it for, right? I mean, that's the first question we ask. And then it depends on their credit, and it depends on what their home is worth. Some of them, it's like interest only for the first 10 years, and some you would have the opportunity to pay principal and interest. But it really design a plan to what their specific needs are to be able to go out in the marketplace and do what they need to get done.
And Robert, are these very expensive? Are they hard to get? What's the story behind that?
So they're not as expensive as refinancing, for sure. Mm-hmm. However, you do have to have good credit. And so if you don't have great credit, we still have those conversations, and there's ways for us to work on your credit score to get those up before we apply for it. That's why we need the time.
I think you talked about that a show or two ago about how to improve your credit. And then what about with the interest rates now? I mean, we feel, I think you're on the same side of the table, that by the end of the year we should see rates a little bit lower. Do people lock in that rate, a variable rate? Or can you even get a locked-in rate with a HELOC?
So you can. You're going to make at least a minimum of 6 payments, and then we can roll it over if you take all the money out. It's part of that conversation, and just because we help you with financing doesn't mean we go away. I mean, reality is, I talk to folks about buying cars and what should they lease, should they buy? You know, we go through all those financing options because eventually it's going to come back to be part of their debt to income when they go to refinance or buy a house in the future. So we're here to have all those conversations.
And Robert, I think we have to make sure people understand what HELOC stands for. Tell us what HELOC stands for.
Thank you. It stands for Home Equity Line of Credit.
Yeah.
So, for instance, we can give you a line of credit for $100,000, but that doesn't mean you have to use the whole 100. You can use 50, and that's a very common thing.
And do you recommend people set that up even if they don't maybe need the money now? Should they set one up and just have it there in case they need it?
If they have a large purchase or something that they need that they're thinking about in the future, for sure. Okay. Any kind of home improvement, those types of options during this time, it's really a great option to do.
Great. Well, Robert, thank you very much. Great information as always. We will talk to you next week, and you have a great great weekend.
Brent, have a great one. Talk to you soon.
You too. Bye-bye. Again, that is Robert Behick. He is a president of Countywide Mortgage Lending. Keep in mind, they're one of the top 100 mortgage companies in America since 2012. They've been here for over 30 years. Robert gives you his cell phone, so give him a call if you got questions on a HELOC or other lending questions. Give him a call at 760-443-3821. Again, that's 760-443-3821, or go to countywidemortgagelending.gemcorp.com.
Countrywide Mortgage Lending is a division of Golden Empire Mortgage, Incorporated, NMLS number 1104585, licensed by the Department of Financial Protection and Innovation under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. Countrywide Mortgage Lending is an equal housing lender and proud member of the BBB.
All right, let's go back to, we left off, we're going to start talking about Weight Watchers and what's going on with that. So Oprah Winfrey, who was a big proponent of this back, I believe it was in 2015, and the stock went up, I believe, to like $40, $45 a share, and she is now going to step down from the board in May. We'll go with the numbers for you to see if it's a buy or not. But she announced on an interview with People magazine that she is now taking weight loss medication, so hence she's not using Weight Watchers any longer. And she's going to step aside. She's going to donate her proceeds of stocks and options and so forth to the National Museum of African American History and Culture. But I think this is going to be a problem because she should have stepped aside and sold her shares before she announced to People's Magazine that she's taking this drug, which a lot of people are doing. There's pros and cons to that, but it's destroyed the stock.
Yeah, and I mean, it's kind of interesting to see how this is going to shake out, whether there's going to be lawsuits involved or, you know, how that's going to go. But it's definitely an interesting story. And I mean, you said that she's been a part of that since 2015. I thought it was longer than that. I mean, it seems like she's always been affiliated with Weight Watchers. I mean, that might be what it is, but I just, whenever I think of Oprah, I think of Weight Watchers.
You know, I think she may have been a proponent of it, but she was not on the board in 2015.
That could be it.
Yeah, so she might go further back. And people all know that over a lifetime, she's struggled with, you know, weight gain, weight loss, and so forth. So, and I don't believe, we'll still get the numbers, but I don't believe that these drugs are the catch-all. I've seen the negatives to them. The other thing, too, it's kind of like financial investing, planning, and so forth. You still need to do the right things. You still need to exercise. You still need to eat the right foods. Just taking a drug for your lifetime is not very good. And the biggest proponent or the biggest negative I saw to it is that with people not eating, you know, just taking the drug, they're going to lose protein. And what's going to happen, they're going to age faster because your muscles will deteriorate. And that's the biggest cause for old age. So it's everybody wants the quick and easy route. Mm-hmm. The best thing is to have a Weight Watchers or somebody with a planned diet and exercise. The drug, I see lawsuits down the road.
I mean, it. When you say that, Brent, I mean, when you look at something that is worth it, like your health, there's no shortcuts, kind of like your financial health as well. There's no shortcuts to building your financial house and making it strong and sturdy, and same with your actual health. I mean, it seems easy to hop on this drug and, you know, drop some pounds, but you're right, if you're doing it the right way or you're doing it the wrong way, you know, who knows what the long-term repercussions of this going to be. And it seems like anytime there's something quick and easy like this, it's never good long-term.
Yeah, and that's so true. And I just realized the Smart Investing Show is kind of like the food show. We talked about pizza, now talking about Weight Watchers. But let's give you some numbers, because with this pullback, this could create some value here, but we got to check the numbers again. There, Weight Watchers, a symbol is WW in the personal services industry. A lot of short on this, 23.3, which means people think it's going to go even lower. 84% institutional owned. No PE ratio, which means they have no earnings over the last 12 months. Price to sales, 0.3. They have no price to book value, no price to cash flow, which means they have no cash flow, have no value. You take away the liabilities and the assets, no value there. This is not looking very good so far. No earnings growth. Sales over the last year are down 12.8%. They do not pay a dividend. Look at the balance sheet. They've got a decent quick ratio, which means they have some liquidity. They can make it through some short time here. It's a 1.1 above the industry of 0.8. There's no debt to equity because there's, well, the debt exceeds the equity, obviously. And I don't have, unfortunately, time. Maybe I will take a look at the balance sheet to see how much debt they actually carry. We do see a net profit margin of a negative 6 versus a positive 7.5 for the industry. Return on equity, 8.1. Industry's at 38.4, so they're struggling there. Looking at the share price, we do see that the share price currently is $3.38. The 52-week high is $13.31. The low is $3.09, so they're bumping around that low area there. And let's take a look at the analysts here, see what they say about it going forward. We do have, going out to December 2024, seven analysts give a mean estimate of 18 cents. Now, over the last 90 days, that's down 40%. It was 30 cents before. So right now, you got a target sell price of about $3 a share, about where it is. Be very careful of trying to say, well, I'm going to catch this thing here. It's going to turn around. I do believe there is value to a Weight Watchers, but it could take longer to get there. Again, dieting and so forth is important. I don't think these drugs are going to be the catch-all to where it's like, give it some time, but they could file bankruptcy, come out of bankruptcy, and still be around. As an investor, you'd lost everything.
Yeah, and I mean, this whole event with Oprah is relatively recent, so it seems like, based on the numbers that you're talking about, Brent, there's definitely more room for it to come down. So I would be very cautious of looking at that right now.
Yeah, and we're always trying to find things on sale, and we can buy something and we get it on sale. It's possible it goes on sale more, 10, 15, 20% more. You'll never actually get the absolute bottom, but there's got to be some value there. And you've got to be careful of bankruptcy, because companies have done this. They recapitalize, and that means a shareholder is wiped out, but the company is still there. So be very careful of saying, yes, this is going to turn around. Gee, I can get it for $3 a share. I remember Peter Lynch saying that, yeah, you buy the stock at 3 because it went from 30 down to 3. Yeah, you think you're catching something, but goes from 3 down to $1.50, you still lost 50%.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of people don't look at the numbers that way, but yeah, I mean, there's still potentially a lot to lose, and if it goes down to 0 because of bankruptcy, you lose everything.
Well, let's talk about, and again, I didn't do this intentionally.
More food?
More food. Starbucks. I was going to look at Starbucks because I've been watching Starbucks for quite a while, and they just seem to be stuck in this area. So I want to take a look at the numbers on Starbucks to see if this could be a buy. And do you use Starbucks? You probably don't.
My wife does. My wife has a little app, and she gets her gift cards and goes there. Not a ton. She's not like somebody who goes every day or anything like that. No.
Yeah, it's what's up? I've not been in a while, but I think it's like $5 now for
something like that. I mean, whenever I go, I just get black coffee. I mean, I'm too afraid to ask for all the crazy names that they have there. So
I just go and it's like, can I have a medium? I'm sorry, yeah. I don't know what. Just give me a medium. they know what I'm talking about. But they're in the restaurant industry, not much short on the float side. 1.2%, 76% institutional owned. They trade at 24.9 times earnings in the past. That's below the industry at 28.4. That's a positive. Price of sales 2.9 versus 2.7. Price of cash flow 15.7 versus 17.8. That's a good sign. We do see the PEG ratio 1.5 versus 5.7. Again, the lower the PEG ratio, the better. So that is a positive. Now, I am happy to see this. The earnings over the last year are up 30%, but the whole industry is up 60%. Sales for Starbucks up 11.5. That is better than the industry at 5.9. I am wrong on them slowing down here. The analysts, anyways, compare the analysts. They say 5-year growth rate 16% on their earnings. That's above the industry 11.9. So they think a lot of people are going to keep drinking Starbucks here. They do pay a nice dividend, 2.5%. Only use 57%. Their earnings pay that out. That's a positive. Look at the balance sheet. We got a current ratio 0.7 versus 1.1. That's a little bit on the low side. I'd be a little bit concerned with that. We do see debt to equity not material versus 1 for the industry. They could have the debt exceeds the equity of the business. That could be a problem. Net profit margin, well, 11.7 versus 9.5. So for every Starbucks you go in there and you pay for, they keep about 12% of that is what they actually do. Return on equity, very strange, a negative 49.8 versus a negative 230. I don't know why that's a negative. You'd have to look at the numbers in more detail on the financial statements to see that. Here's the situation. I mean, the price right now is $93.16. The high, $115.48. The low for the last year has been $89.21. I can't verify this because I don't have time to look at the chart, but I'm pretty sure if you look at this for the last at least 2 years, I feel it's been around in the 90s to the 100s. 110 for at least for a couple of years. It's just not moving. And I think part of the problem could be with China, could be part of the problem. Going out to October 2025, we've got 34 analysts, and they say that the mean estimate of those earnings are $4.74. And I just closed my app here on my calculator, so let me do that real quick. 474 times 16.6 gives me a target sell price of 78.68. Now, again, we are pretty cautious. We don't like to overpay for things. That's why I don't go to Starbucks too often buy it. It's just still too pricey. And I know from what I've read, they're having troubles in China. China's having troubles and not doing as well there.
I know one thing that I think is kind of interesting about Starbucks is they have their app and you can preload money onto it. So basically, Starbucks has this huge bank of people that have credits with them, and then they take those credits and they invest it, because essentially they have an interest-free loan of all these people that preload their apps with money.
Wow.
And so they invest that money. So I thought that was kind of an interesting way to generate additional revenue.
And if it's only, I don't know, $10, $20, you take that times, I don't know, how many customers they have? 10 million? I don't even know.
Oh, I'm sure it's more than that. Yeah, so, yeah. I mean, if they've got hundreds of millions, it adds up. It's a lot.
That
up.
Well, I didn't know that, so thanks, Sarah. Well, there's a closing bell. Unfortunately, thank you for listening to the Smart Investing Show. It is for information purposes only and should not be used as investment advice. If you'd like to discuss in more detail your investment needs or have other investment questions, feel free to call myself, Brent Wilsey, or Chase Wilsey at 858-224-0004. Again, that's 858-224-0004. And be sure to listen to the podcast. You can get that at our website. A lot of great information there. SmartInvesting2000.com. That's SmartInvesting2000.com. And sign up for the newsletter there as well. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week right here on the Smart Investing Show.
I did all that. And may I say,